This is the Friends Vistra Debating Society. I am Gaius. Germanicus is here, so we're the retired centurions, one of whom was in Judea the 10 years before the Jewish revolt and has much to tell us, but he's a happy fellow and we're not going to tell us tonight. Well, I have some reflections from him. We're going to turn to a much more fun topic, which is Germanicus has taken the time to assemble a list of what you'd have to say, how empires go wrong. Seven warning signs of what Germanicus calls self-harm. That's very generous. Self-destruction would be closer. That America, of course, entertains all the time. Oh, what's an example? Well, the emperor's decided that Nigeria needs his attention. You go, what? Okay, we know what Nigeria is. It's a large country, largest in Africa, ruled by a complete non-entity named Tinubu, who was elected, but he's an aged man, and his job is to protect the money that flows into Paris in the accounts of the rest of the leadership in Abuja. And the money is from the light sweet crude because they're blessed with the best oil on the planet. The rest of the country goes to the devil. North, the South, the internecine rivalry. And the emperor decides, all of a sudden somebody whispers in his ear, they're killing Christians. No kidding. They've been doing that for generations. Sheep herders and goats herders called Fulani are Muslims. And they regard it as sport and necessary in their religion. Every once in a while, wipe out a church in the Christian parts of the country. Okay. I've reported on it over the years. But here we go again. The president says, stop it. Now he's right. That's what must be. Let's put it this way. In Nigeria, they're going, well, we've got to deny this, but he is right. You ask yourself, why doesn't Nigeria stop it? Because it's not really a country. It's an oil revenue is what it is. It has rebellions routinely. And it has a very sophisticated frontier of jihadists in the north that buffer it from the jihadists who are all in the West African countries of Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, all of whom are Islamic Republic, far away and has nothing to do with America today. Nothing. I go through all these steps to make sure that you understand this is live, that we're going to go on this adventure with no purpose whatsoever. Ask yourself, what is America's interest here? None. None whatsoever. Same for Venezuela. There's no interest here. The president's going to make the case that it's about defending America from drugs, but if that was true, bomb Mexico or bomb Detroit, make it safe from drugs. These are the things that empires do to entertain themselves. It's not un-Roman to entertain yourself with a rebellion somewhere. I mentioned that we all know about the Jewish revolt in 66 AD, and the Romans came in and destroyed the city by 70, wiped it out, murdered everybody. The reason we have Christianity and rabbinic Judaism is because they escaped the city before the final destruction. When Rome destroyed a city, it was gone. Gone. There were no Jews left in Jerusalem after the massacre, but they came back eventually over centuries as a demonstration of faithfulness. However, I mentioned that the Rome had done that before. It wasn't the only time Rome did that. Around 4 BCE, 5 BCE, about the time of the birth of Jesus, there was a revolt in the north of Judea. It was called Judea at that time. It was renamed Palestine because when the Romans wiped it out, they said, we're going to rename you. We're not going to give you Judea back. So they said, let's name it for the Philistines. That's in their storytelling of people who are ignorant. So they named it Palestine for the Philistines. But when it was Judea, they came south with three legions from Syria, three, and wiped out a town named Sephanus. What? What am I talking about? Sephanus. It was the capital of Galilee. You've never heard of it. They wiped it out. They're doing archival work now, trying to recover it. You can see the mosaic floors Look at your Bible. You see Nazareth? Well, it was 4 miles north of Nazareth. It was the capital. And they wiped it out. That's who the Romans are. That's how they took care of their self-interest. Whereas our emperor, Mr. Trump, seems to be willy-nilly. Now and again, somebody whispers in his ear, Nigeria's allowing Christians to be murdered by Muslims, and he decides that we're going to go make it an adventure. Well, that's my example of self-harm, which is not paying close attention to what interest is it of the American people? What's in it for us? A very good question. That's my list, but Germanicus has a much more articulate list. So we're going to turn to it, Germanicus. A very good evening to you. We'll go through it as routinely as you do. Your first recommendation to America. We do this all the time, Germanicus. You made up a list of our history. What is your first recommendation? Good evening to you.
Good evening, guys. These warnings, or what I call warning signs, I've tried to distill into maxims, you know, little, much less than a parable, but something that you should pay attention to at all times and keep foremost in your mind when you are engaging in the practice of strategy and war. And having spent the entirety of the 25 years since 9/11 teaching strategy and war and advising people who call themselves war fighters, one can look across the length and breadth of the war fighter world in the United States, and you can see how these maxims were and have been in those 25 years since 9/11 routinely broken, transgressed, thrown away, ignored, denied. And the first of these warnings is simple. I think they're all ultimately simple. And that is, never let someone else, i.e. a foreign power, quote unquote, never let someone else define your interests and objectives, and then tell you how urgent must be their achievement. And we've suffered for that. Our narrative, our sacred narrative, covers up the downside of letting some foreign power step in and entangle you, to use the word of George Washington from the farewell address. So we can look past the Kuomintang under Chiang Kai-shek, ensnared the Republican side of U.S. politics, and that had a profound effect on our relationship with China all the way until Nixon went to Beijing. The British ensnared the United States in two world wars and did it very adroitly, and they did it mostly through propaganda, but also through what you might call personal squeeze in the form of Winston Churchill. And today we have a foreign power, actually several, who do their best to manipulate us. Ukraine is one. The various NATO countries and Britain, of course, still trying to leverage us when it comes to Ukraine policy. But also, more visibly, I think, Saudi Arabia, to some extent Qatar, and of course, Israel. And we have allowed the U.S. to be shaped into courses of action which have proven disastrous and in which we have no inherent national interest. And unfortunately, we're still in that mode to some extent. And that can be devastating. It has been devastating, and it's devastating right now.
A good lesson. Never get entangled in somebody else's failure.
And let them manipulate you. Yeah.
I was thinking of Saigon.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes, that was more of a submissive client state that got out of hand.
Oh, Lord. Second lesson, never let initial success fool you into thinking you're winning. So again, we do it all the time, Germanicus. You've come up with the centurions are laughing as you give these suggestions, of course, because they've been through this so many times.
Oh, yeah.
You win the battle the first day, you think you've won.
Well, others have fallen prey to that. I mean, the most obvious example is the Japanese after Pearl Harbor, and they were, in their own words, infected with what they called a victory disease.
Yes.
But I mean, that's part of that is understandable because the Japanese went into war with the U.S. in the most pessimistic and state of mind imaginable. Then none of them believed any good would come of this. So sure, after this great victory, they let it go to their heads.
Did they give us the virus? Is that where it came from, Germanicus?
Well, we've suffered from this all the way up and down. I mean, George Washington, after the battle of what we call Bunker Hill, which was such a tremendous, brutal beatdown of Britain, Washington thought, well, I mean, let them come and land in New York because we'll do the same thing we did in Bunker Hill, Breed's Hill. And of course, it didn't work out that way. And there's one disaster after another. There's our invasion of Canada in 1812. There's the belief that Lincoln and his circle had that, oh, and we've got our volunteers. We're just going to march and put down this rebellion. And, you know, all of the elite, the yuppies of 1861 came out in their carriages to have picnics and watch this glorious event, which turned out poorly, shall we say. And, you know, the modern retelling of this is equally profound in that there's no possible way for us to learn the lesson. The Iraq War, the invasion of Iraq, was such an example of that, where we just walked over what was essentially a moribund military, ill-equipped, dispirited, not well-trained, no high-end systems, no, you know, none of the integration synthesis of information required to fight modern war. And we thought it was a glorious victory. And it meant we'd achieved everything. Now Iraq would become a democracy. It'd become a U.S. ally, blah, blah, blah. Well, guess what happened? Afghanistan was worse because there at least we won, and we won in a creative way. And then we just let it go for like 18 months while we turned our attention to Iraq. It's very hard because every single engagement since 2001 has been like that. And it has, I think, culminated in the war in Ukraine, which we put together and which we pushed. And the U.S. elites were so cock in the hoop, so over the moon about the initial success that the Ukrainian military had, and then followed up with these small, extremely costly counteroffensives, as they were called, you know, in Kherson and elsewhere. And it's mind-boggling how we kept on not just assuming that Ukraine would win handily, but when it didn't win handily, we would continue to keep harping on the initial victory that had been, after a year or so of war, been proven to be not the bellwether for the future.
Number three, Germanicus, you're beating a dead Afghan horse here.
Pony.
Hey, stay the course. That's another way of saying we lose. We do it every time. We're doing it right now.
Well, something came to me years ago, and I mean years ago, about Vietnam. And what hit me was that, well, Nixon promised to end the war, but he couldn't do that. He had to stay in and find peace with honor. And the truth of the matter is, if he'd just gotten out and said, hey, this is a Democrat war, LBJ made this war, and we're getting out, it would have been clean. It would have been clean. No one would have blamed him.
Air Germanicus, let's for the kids.
Yes.
LBJ made the war up.
Yeah.
Made up to get elected in 64.
A whole cloth. Let's not go down the rabbit hole. But the key element here is, again, is simple. the sooner you get out, the sooner things get better. And as I put it, the failure you were forced to accept later, that's forced upon you, is always going to be worse than the failure that you choose now. It's your choice. You're in control. And this is, it can't sink in. Americans simply can't sink in. And they're not Americans, by the way. They're the courtiers in the imperial city. They're the ones who are worried about their reputation. As you put it with BJ, you know, their hold on political power. And they really don't care. They believe that somehow if we just stick it out, it will get better. I can't tell you how many commentators and experts like Robert Kaplan, for example, would tell me, and that was the sort of messaging of the 2003-04 period was, we'll muddle through, whatever the hell that really means. I mean, we did muddle through. We got out and with our tail between our legs.
Number four, don't let yourself have your biases confirmed by the enemy. Well, my reading of that is 1942, the assumption was that the Japanese can't fly those airplanes the way we can.
But they had poor eyesight, genetically poor eyesight. Right.
And so Pearl Harbor was a freak. It won't happen again. My God, they actually thought that. They actually committed themselves to strategy thinking the Japanese would break.
Well, you have to understand, because this was my first book and PhD thesis, is that the Navy had been preparing for a war with Japan, a war that was essentially
Plan Orange, 1917.
They would gather together the battle fleet, and those 12 battle wagons would steam across the entire Pacific in one bound, and then they would defeat the Japanese fleet in a glorious battle.
You had been there and challenged them, they would have asked you to leave the room.
No. That happened to me with my war college colleagues for real. And it happened over Afghanistan. I said in 2011, and to all my colleagues, all what 60 or 70 of them, I said, this war is a loser. There's no reason to continue it. And of course, you know, they got upset, very, 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 very upset. And the issue here is that they call it confirmation bias, but your biases are really ultimately your deepest desires. And people don't want to admit to their deepest desires, and they certainly don't want to admit that those desires are the instrument that controls their rational thought. Hence, any analysis is going to push to satisfy your desires at any cost. And of course, the cost is often defeat.
All right, number we've had four. We'll do the next three in just a moment. I want to recap for people who are taking notes. All right, never let a foreign power define your goals. Hence, Zelensky. Never let Zelensky define your goals, or Mark Rutte of Brussels define your goals, or Keir Starmer of London define your goals. I could go on. Never let them define your goals. Well, of course, we're letting them define our goals. Number two, your initial success is not a success, okay? You're going to lose if you think it is, guaranteed. We're headed out to Virginia to have this showdown with the Rebs. We'll run over them the first day, and they'll be fleeing back, and we'll walk into Richmond. Bang. Okay, number three. If anybody says stay the course in the room, smile and quit because it's over. The Centurions are all nodding. Okay, and number four. Your judgment of the enemy should not be confirmed by your bias about the enemy. The Japanese can't fly airplanes. What happened at Pearl Harbor was a freak. We were not ready to defend ourselves. When we come back, more of Germanicus's recommendation to no one in Washington because they'll never listen, ever. That's why this is fun. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. Yes, it's a cool autumn evening. The Thames is turbulent. We're going to go to the theater later and see more Seneca because he's apparently hit a strain around here. I had no idea everybody's aware for bloodletting at the emperor's level, but they are. Maybe it's because Domitian is wearing down our patience. He's obsessed. He's a Flavian, but he's the weakest of the three Flavians. And the food is good. There's still, no, the swan meat's all gone. That was just a week at the end. But we're entertaining ourselves with our centurions. And maybe we'll have time for a story about the Jewish revolt to remind everybody what an empire does when it wants to win. It wipes out the enemy, wipes them out, doesn't rebuild them, wipes them out. No matter how they rationalize it afterwards, they're done. That's how Rome won. And when the United States comes back to that, they'll realize that the success of the 20th century was that there was not a standing building in Berlin in July of 45, not one. It was bricks. That's Rome. That was America when it was Rome. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.